I want to bring them before you some things, assuming that God will allow me to deliver them. That may not be the most enjoyable, most uplifting sermon you've heard this week, or maybe heard in the last few weeks. But if the Lord blesses me to relieve the burden of my heart, what I have to say tonight, it will be probably more useful, and by useful I mean day after day, than anything I've probably dealt with during this week. As I look back at my experience in life, I can recall sermons that to me were very enjoyable and greatly uplifting at the time, but I've not found all that much practical application of from them in the daily battles of life. I also recall some other sermons various men have preached in my lifetime that at a particular time I did not really, to use the word enjoy, it's the uplift from them that I have gotten from some preaching, that I find myself even to this day using some of those things that were preached to me, and some of these things were preached probably 60 years ago. But be that as it may, regardless if the effects of it are uplifting, or the effects of it are enjoyable, or if the, regardless what the effects are, that's not my responsibility. My responsibility is to just try to sow the seed, and the effects of it, of course, are in the hands of the Lord. I ask you to pray for Dave to give us a physical, spiritual, and strength that it takes to preach the gospel, and also that pray for yourselves, that the Lord might anoint and touch the ears of all present, that we might receive the word if indeed it is preached. With most of us that read the Bible very much are well aware that the Bible has a great deal to say about deceivers. And we can think of such scriptures as 2 Timothy chapter 3, where the Apostle Paul describes the period here that he refers to as the last days. And I said several years ago, back the first time I ever studied it carefully, that I found there about 19 signs of a period he described as the last days. After reading it a little more carefully, I found about 21. Maybe you're a better Bible reader than I am. Maybe you can find 23 or 24. But I have found at least 21. But as we look at these signs of this period that the Apostle Paul refers to as the last days, he said, evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. That tells us that one of the signs of the last days is deception everywhere. It also indicates to us that deceivers will not only be more numerous, but that they will be more skillful. We're living in a world where there's all kinds of deceit in the news media, all kinds of deceit in advertising, and I've told my wife a number of times, she spends a lot more time with advertising than I do. I said most all advertising has got some form of deception in it. You ought to drink Folger because it's mountain grown. Of course it is. Coffee won't grow anywhere else. All coffee grown beans are raised in mountains. Of course, I could give you a little lecture on why you probably ought to drink Arabica instead of Robusta, but I'll spare you that. Now, we're also told from time to time that here's a young man with straw hair, sort of looks like a scarecrow with an Adam's apple sticking way out, and the girls would pay him no attention. But back in my day, if he'd used Brill cream, or a splash on a particular lotion, or if he had bought a particular expensive jacket, but the girls would be everywhere. I've got bad news for your son. Brill cream, little expensive perfume, probably that expensive jacket, probably not going to make all that much difference. We also see constantly on TV, if you watch it very much, here's advertisements where folk come out with these very sleek bodies. Back in my day, we referred to them as washboard abs. I think today they're referred to as six-packs. So here we see folk obviously able to take nourishment, folk who could take out group insurance all by themselves, and folk who obviously overnourished, and very displeased with themselves. So if they'll buy this super-duper gadget that just came out, you'll wind up looking like these folks. You'll wind up looking like this ideal young man over here with Mr. America physique and this obviously trim, well-built young lady. Usually in these advertisements, they'll show sit-ups and crunches leg raises are such as this, and people lifting barbells and dumbbells, and they'll draw very miserable as to do it, and they'll draw a slash to it. This is not the way to do it. You've got to have our gadget, which has just come out. The deception that's in that is that those people built those bodies using the very tactics that they're condemned. Those bodies were built with crunches, leg raises, probably built with weights and such as that. I do know they could not have been built with this gadget that's just come out, because it takes months, even years, to build a body like that, and the gadget just came out, remember? They couldn't have built them with the gadget. It just came out. That gadget will probably become fuel for a yard sale. And it's pretty well known when young men buy such things, usually mother develops better muscles moving it around to be able to vacuum under it than son does, because he uses it a few days and leaves it behind. There's deception in this world all around. All kinds of deception. We find the Bible has a great deal to say about being deceived by false prophets. We find Satan himself is referred to as a deceiver. Lord constantly warns his disciples, be not deceived. We find, he tells us first, there arise false Christ and false prophets. We are told in Matthew chapter 7, verse 14, they're told to beware of false prophets. Why? Because they shall come to you like wolves, like in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they're ravening wolves. Now the false prophet, Mr. Wolf, that put on the sheep's clothing, does a very good job of trying to appear like a true prophet, but there's one thing he forgets to cover up. He didn't cover his feet, and if you'll watch him long enough, it may take a while, he'll leave behind wolf tracks. But sometimes it takes a little while to notice that. So most folks, when a preacher gets up and mentions that he wants to speak on the subject of deception, probably the first thing you think about is false prophets and deceivers and such that we have in this world, and they're out there in abundance. We also think of Satan the deceiver, and we think of evil forces and influences that are around us trying to deceive us constantly. But if it's Lord's will, I want to talk about a type of deceit that folks don't think about much. And a type of deceit that I've never thought about all that much, and never tried to preach on it. And if this sermon sounds unprepared, unrehearsed, and disorganized, that's for a very simple reason. That's because it is. Now, there are some preachers I hear spend lots of time preparing sermons. I usually spend a lot more time repairing sermons. Usually afterward, I think of things we should have said that. On the way home, text come into my mind that illustrates it better than what I was trying to say. And I remember long years ago when I first met Elder Walter Evans, now gone home to be with the Lord. He said, you know, there's preachers out here in the world that they think about the sermons and think about them, then they preach them. He said, you know, we have a way we preach them and then think about them. And sometimes, if the Lord blesses me to preach, I sometimes think about it a lot more after I preached it than maybe I did before. But depending on the guidance of the Spirit of God, the type of deceit I want to talk to you about tonight, Lord willing, is self-deceit. 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 And as I began to think about that subject not very long ago, I became amazed at how much there is in the Bible about it. Although I tried to read the Bible as such I could read anything, I was not aware that there is as much in the Bible about self-deceit, deceiving ourselves as there is. And some of you folks maybe wrote a project, just go through the Bible sometime and start counting up the warnings against deceiving ourselves, self-deceit. We, all of us that feel our responsibility to the Lord, can see the importance of telling the truth to other people. God's people, when they think straight, can recognize that lying is an abomination inside of God. God's people have a responsibility to try to tell the truth to the very best of their understanding. And I try to tell the truth as I understand it to God's people, and it's our responsibility to try to tell the truth in conversation. And while I'm at that, I'm going to make a little distinction. Quite often I'll have very good people come up to me and say, "Brother Powers, I lied to you. I told you my mama was 91, and I talked to her, she's 93. You didn't lie to me. You just passed on some false and wrong information. You thought she was one age, told me that, and that was not lying." Then sometimes you'll find folks say, "I told you such and such happened such and such on such and such time. I lied to you. I found it was actually such and such." A person like that's not lying. There's a difference in lying and passing on incorrect information. There's been lots of times in my life I thought something was true. I really believed it's true. And maybe told it to other folk, found out later it wasn't. I repeat what I said to you last night. Your judgment is no better than your information. Be very sure of your information. And the reason he said, "Well, you said that last night." Yes, I'm going to say it again tonight. We're afflicted today with folk who will patrol the internet in midnight hours, and here's a little fragment. No proof, no documentation, just a little fragment. And they just take off and run with it, spread it from the river to the ends of the earth. Or the least little rumor, least little suggestion becomes a concrete fact and spread to the four winds. I repeat once again, your judgment is no better than your information. Better be sure of your information. Now, as I think about this, we've already mentioned, all of us recognize, the responsibility we have to tell each other the truth. But tonight, I want to emphasize the importance that we have of telling ourselves the truth. A lot of folk, as they go through this life, have told themselves lies. They believe those lies, and they base their actions on those lies. And I have books at home written by what I consider to be competent psychiatrists. Some of them are as nutty as their patients. Some of them have their heads screwed on life. And the counselors and various folks, I've read what folk have to say about some of the issues and troubles of life. And I've read statements by some of them that a good percentage of the people who come to visit them, their main problem is what they refer to as a misbelief. Well, that's very kind, isn't it? A misbelief. That's nice. That's professional. I'm going to refer to it as myths, or just plain lies. Sometimes folks convince themselves of lies and then base their life's actions based on something that's a myth. It's a lie. It's a misbelief, if you prefer. Okay, very well, as we begin to look at what I'm trying to set before you tonight, regardless if you want to label this self-deceit or if you want to label it the importance of telling yourself the truth, that doesn't matter. That's up to you. I want to quote a very few scriptures right quickly to just give you a little idea of how many warnings there are against self-deceit in the Bible. I find in the 37th chapter of Jeremiah, verse 9, "The long suffering of God has come to an end with the people of Israel, and the Babylonian army," which right here is called Chaldeans, that's just another name for Babylon, "the Babylonian army is going to come against them and destroy their city and carry them away into captivity." They've also been warned by the prophets of God that don't deceive yourselves into thinking this captivity is going to be short. They said when you're carried over into Babylon, don't get the idea this is going to be over in a week or two. When you get into Babylon, marry wives, have families, because you're going to be there 70 years. God says you're going to be over there a long time. And someone that thinks, well, this will be over in a week or two, is just deceiving themselves. Then, apparently, there was some people in the camp of Israel, like a lot of folks today, have the idea, well, this is going to go away. You know, don't feed it, it'll go away. Just leave it alone, and maybe it'll go away. Jeremiah 37, verse 9, God tells his prophets to tell, prophet to tell the people, deceive not yourselves. By saying the Chaldeans will go away, he says they're not going away. They're coming, judgment is coming, and he said to say otherwise is to deceive yourselves. We come to such passages as 1 John chapter 1 verse 8. The beloved apostle John says, if we say that we have no sin, You ever met folks like that? I've met a few. I met quite a few right here in this very city in 1970. I got into a bit of dialogue with a so-called Mormon preacher the other day. And in our discussion, there came a time when she said to me, there's a difference in my flesh and your flesh. I got sanctified and got the Holy Ghost when I was 12 years of age and haven't committed the same sins. Well, if you're doing a little, if you've been doing math at all, that's 35 years ago. I was a bit younger than I am now. And back then, I was a fire-breathing dragon in the pulpit. That's before I became a over-the-hill, no longer a 305-time grandfather, obviously overflowing with the milk of human kindness. Back then, I said back to her, if you don't have any sin, where are you getting all those wrinkles and all that gray hair? I said, once you get sin out of your body, you're going to stop aging, you're not going to die. She didn't have a bit of sense of humor, didn't laugh a bit. Instead, our faces got this close. She went to screaming at me in the unknown tongue. And I said to her, please, sister, my God is not deaf. She said to me, my God is not nervous. Well, she stopped my clock. Maybe her God isn't nervous, but she's making me a bit nervous. I have met a few folks that claim they don't have any sin. Bible says they're deceiving themselves. If we say that they have no sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us. We also find that James deals with people who deceive themselves. That is, they lie to themselves. They tell themselves a misbelief, myth or lie, and believe. We come to James chapter 1, verse 22, and James says, but be ye doers of the word, and not hearers only. Then he gives us a comparison to further show us the necessity of doing the word, not just hearing. But be ye doers of the word, and not just hearers only. He says, if any man be a hearer of the word, and not a doer, he's like a man that beholdeth his natural face in a glass, which that's our old-time language for a mirror, and it's not really all that old-time. I'm old enough, I remember when mirrors were called looking glasses. But be that as it may, he beholds his natural face in the glass, and he says as soon as he goes away, he forgetteth what manner of man he was. And I think most everybody's had some experience with this. I suppose everybody in this congregation spent some time in front of mirrors before he came here. Most of us look bad enough. You ever wonder how we look in old mirrors in the world? Some folks spend a lot more time in front of them than others. There's a reason they're called vanity mirrors. You're quiet here. Glad you came, aren't you? Okay, very well. He says that person just hears it and won't do it, or doesn't do it, is deceiving himself. He says, but be ye doers of the word, not just hearers only. Part I left out a minute ago, excuse me, deceiving your own selves. He says a person that hears it, doesn't put it in practice, they're deceiving themselves. And then he uses an example of somebody deceiving themselves. Left that clause out a minute ago, at least I'm aware of it. He ain't doers of the word, not just hearers only, deceiving your own selves. Now he says a person that does that is like unto a man, goes to a mirror, beholds his natural face in the glass. And when you go to the mirror shows you the wrinkles, the defects, the thinning hair, all this type of thing. And sometimes we're shocked. I still feel about 30 or 35 years of age. I think I'm a real young fella till I go to the mirror. And sometimes I go to the mirror and say, hey, old guy, get out of there so I can shave. Of course, I'd rather have it that way than the other. Because some of you folks here probably 30 or 35 probably feel 65, but thank God with me still the other way. I feel real young when I go to the mirror. But anyway, spend a little time for the mirror, and we leave, and we very soon convince ourselves, well, it wasn't really that bad. And he says he forgets what manner of man he was. And the comparison he makes, whoso looketh into the perfect law of liberty. That's what you do every time you read God's book. That's what you do when a minister of the gospel holds up the mirror of the word before you. And sometimes when I look into that book, it shows me what I am, shows me how far short I come, and I kind of see myself as I am. Or the man of God holds up the gospel mirror, and we can recognize that we're coming short, and what we really need to do. But it's very easy to close the book or to leave this meeting house. And you pass a tavern over here, or you find folk out here that are shooting drugs in the street, or things like that. And you might say, well, I'm not so bad. I went to a meeting tonight. I went to the house of God. Look what they're doing. And by the time you get home, you don't feel so bad about yourself. He says, he forgetteth what manner of man he is. Then he goes on and says, if any man seem to be religious and bridleth not his tongue, he says, this man deceiveth himself, his religion is vain. We'll say this right quick about bridling the tongue. In the days when I rode horses, and some of you folk here plowed with horses and mules, that bridle was not put on that horse to stop him. I keep that horse from doing anything. It's put on there to guide him. Now, some folk seem to have the idea that the best way to bridle the tongue is just to sit around and say nothing. There's times when saying nothing is a sign of wisdom, sometimes it's a sign of cowardice. The Apostle Paul says, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 11, but study to be quiet. He didn't say simply be quiet, he says study to be quiet. As I look back in my life, I can recall some times in life's journey where I spoke when I wished I'd kept quiet. But I can also recall a number of times when I kept quiet, when I wished I'd said something. There's some things, looking backward, I really believe I could have nipped in the bud if I'd have jumped on the ball for it. And I don't know which list would be the larger, but that last list, times when I wished I had spoken out, and spoken out early, and did not, that list is longer than you might think. He didn't say, keep quiet, he said, steady be quiet. And a long time ago, the old wise man told his son, he said, my son, if wisdom's ways you would seek, the five things you must take care of whom you speak, and to whom, and how, and when, and where. That little right there, form, whatever you want to call it, is a very good guideline on how to study to be quiet. If wisdom's ways you can seek, the five things you must take care of whom you speak, and to whom, and how, and when, and where. I find a time in the Bible, in Acts chapter 5, that the Jewish council had gathered the servants of God, the apostles, together, and they took counsel to slay them, and they killed them. Except there was a man of influence among them named Gamaliel. Influence is one of the most devilish, satanic, sinister things on earth used wrong. It's a very wonderful thing used right. This man of influence stands up among them. He begins to caution them. Man of Gamaliel, a man of reputation among the Jews, honored man. He stands up among them, and I'm not going to quote his entire talk to them. You can read it as well as I can. But that toward the end, this is what he says to them, pertaining to what these men are doing. He says, if this council or this work be of man, it'll come to naught. But if it be of God, you cannot fight it. You can't overthrow it, lest haply you be found to fight against God. He's saying to them, put it to the test. Let's put it to the test. Let's watch it. And there have been many times that things that God's people have made snap judgments on, I've made a few myself, when really it ought to have been put to the test to see what kind of fruit it bears. Because of the influence of the wise man who spoke, they didn't kill those apostles, they beat them and let them go. Now, if a sheriff in this county were to come into this building right now with an arrest warrant, going to arrest me for robbing out a supermarket or breaking into place, I would say about 8 o'clock last night, everybody kept quiet. There's no wisdom in that. There's cowardice. A lot of you folks know where I was last night. I was right here. Now, he says, quiet with his tongue. Person seems to be religious and doesn't study how to use his tongue, of whom you speak, to whom, and how, and when, and where, says that person deceiveth himself, his religion's vain. That's not a strong language. Bible has a great deal to say about self-deceit. It has a great deal to say about people lying to themselves. As I think about various lies, or myth, or misbeliefs, I'll kick that one out in a minute. But our folk have told themselves, Bible is just filled with it. I found, as I traveled along life's journey, a misbelief, just a lie, myth, that a lot of people labor under, and this is a heavy burden. There's a myth of indispensability. What do you mean? What do I mean by that? I mean simply this. That I or you or any of you that in the role in which you're filling life, that you're indispensable. And since I've been the parent of a handicapped child, soon to be 42 years, my son's autistic youth, has an intelligent mind, doesn't speak, had a hard time back when he was younger. I know what it is to have a full-time chair of a handicapped person. My wife was born the burden while I've been away from home. I've tried to take the load off her when I get home. Things are better with us than they were in the early days. Early days, my son had seizures, came to the point of death a few times. There's a few times it got so bad. I beg God to take him and relieve him of all this. Parents, all folks, most all folks, have some problem with this. You have a special problem with it. If you have a disabled person to care for, have a handicapped child to care for, or it may be, it might be a mother, it might be a wife caring for a disabled husband, some of them disabled for early in life, and sometimes the devil runs thoughts through your mind like this. What's going to happen to this person if something happens to me? If I'm taken out of this world, I become disabled myself. What's going to happen to this poor husband I'm having to wait on, or this poor wife I have to wait on, or this poor handicapped child, this blind person, this person over here, that I have to care for them? If I'm taken out of this world, there's no chance for them. What's going to happen to them? That's just one sample of the myth of indispensability. I'm going to give several more, Lord willing. My wife labored under that burden years ago. I labored under it somewhat myself. When I came to face with it long years ago, finally I faced it one day, that type of thinking is just saying to God that out here in this world where there's many, many people, multitudes of people, that out here in this world that the Lord is incapable of finding somebody else or raising somebody else to do the job here I'm doing. That type of thinking is showing total lack of faith in God. You think you're indispensable in the role you're filling? Are you saying that the great omnipotent God of this universe, who has millions of people on this earth, that the Lord is incapable of carrying that on without you? Now, I'll make this very clear. I'm not trying to shirk my responsibility, and I know you're not trying to shirk yours. But such thinking is showing a lack of faith in God. I came to the realization that if I'm taken out of this world, and even my life's taken out of this world, that the great God of heaven has some arrangements he could make, maybe even better than what we're doing. All right, very well. Sometimes wives get it in their heads that their husbands are indispensable to women. Can't live without them, can't make it, can't go on. Sure getting put out in here. Now then, at the present time, it is still, when you compare miles driven to miles flown, according to insurance company statistics, it is still 38-1 safer to fly. I see eyebrows going up like the mission one. If you have any doubt of that, go to an insurance agent. Say that I'd like to buy $250,000 worth of insurance to insure me as I drive my car in my automobile. See how much it costs you. Now I'd like to have $250,000 or $100,000 flight insurance. It'd be much cheaper. It is still, when you compare the miles driven to miles flown, it's still 38-1 safer to fly. What folks don't realize, in Nashville, Memphis, Dallas, all over this nation, people have gotten killed in many places today in automobile crashes, maimed and wounded, happening all the time, at Atlanta, Miami, name the place. But you don't hear about that. Every once in a while, a plane goes down. Still 38-1, safe for the fly. I got a lot of folks over here worried about me spending so much of my time flying.
And I told a lot of folks, I've flown close to a million miles. I can prove in the records I have to keep to the IRS. Oh, you preachers have to pay to. Oh, yes, we're supposed to. I do, don't you? Yes, and my results I keep for them in case I'm ever challenged. I've flown close right at a million miles preaching the gospel. None of that taking vacations. None of that going for R&R, whatever that is. Okay. In all those times I'm talking about, I've been through air pockets, a few things like that, but never felt like my life was in danger. There's two things I found pertaining to flying far more dangerous than airplanes. One of them is airports. They're all been place, including a few times in America. I've flown there, never hit an air pocket. And then, I've had some brother nearly kill me twice trying to get me out of an airport, but he doesn't understand, know the way out of it, and I don't either. And the world's nicest people are usually not around airports. A lot of them late because they didn't allow enough time, and they're not in good attitude. And a lot of these folks come pick me up, not used to being there, and even if they were, I can't figure it out either. I've been in a lot more danger in airports than I have airplanes. Of course, we don't service anything to eat anymore, so the second thing I would have named a few years back, more dangerous about flying than airplanes, of course, is airline food. Okay, very well. Despite all that, we've not got into all that. This time, several years back, back in the 80s, when this crashed about three in a short length of time, and my wife, who's a good soldier, but he's been a very good trooper all these years to keep the home fire burning and has never put one pebble in my way when he came to preach the gospel. And my wife, who is the Primitive Baptist I ought to be, always been a good soldier, for she'd been reading about some of these crashes. I was in the door, about to go to good guy, head somewhere, preach to somebody. Now, she says, just a minute. She said, if you were in one of those crashes and got wiped out, just where do I start? What am I supposed to do? What's the first thing I'm supposed to do? I said, the very first thing? She said, that's right. Where do I start? What's the very first thing? I said, call your attorney son-in-law and get him to sue the airline. Goodbye. In the counseling session. Anybody want a counseling session with me after? I think my fault not. Somebody says, you sure are mean. What do you expect? About a few times in life, my wife, who's a good soldier, real Marine, has said to me, well, especially after my sister lost her husband last August, they're about the same age, very close, what would I do if I lost you? I said, simple, you'll survive. You'll survive. Won't be easy, you'll survive. Through God's grace, you'll survive. You say, some of you young wives out here, maybe some not so young, if any would admit to such, are saying to me, I can't bear that now. I can't take it, can't bear it. Don't even like to think about it. Sure, you don't have the grace to bear it now. God gives you grace when the time comes. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13. There hath no temptation. That word means test or trial. There hath no temptation taking you, but such as is common to man. Now we come to the next lie people tell themselves. And deceiving themselves. People like to tell themselves there's something very special about my trouble. I've talked to a lot of folks. They start telling me about their trouble like there's something very special about it. Nobody knows what I'm going through. Nobody has any idea. Used to be an old black spiritual. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Nobody knows but Jesus. Well, that's fine, a little spiritual, but it's not so. This text says, I have no temptation taken me but such as is common to man. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. You probably wouldn't have to go too far. Wouldn't probably have to search too much. So you find somebody who has been through or gone through something very similar to what you're going through. Now remember, things can be similar without being identical. They're different words. They're spelled differently. They also contain different letters. I would expect any two situations to be identical, people are different. I have seen many situations very similar. There is no temptation taken you but such as is common to man. You know what that says? There's nothing special about my trouble. Sometimes the devil tries to convince me that there's something unique about my trouble. I wake up out where I live, start looking around, all I see everywhere is endless work. Sometimes I tell my wife, I said, that's the only mistake I've ever made in life, I wasn't born 10 people. Now I see a lot of folks who obviously don't have very much to do. And sometimes that starts bothering. Devil starts taking advantage of. Then I get my head straightened on right, I thank the Lord I'm able to do all this. And when I start doing it and quit that, having my little pity party and get out here and start doing it, I'm as happy as I can have good sense. There have no temptation taking you, but something is common to man. Couldn't tell you how many people in my life start describing their trouble. If nobody knows, nobody can imagine, all that type of thing. Nobody, no, I dare have no temptation taking you as common to man, but such as is common to man. He says, but God will not tempt you above that that you're able. We now come to another lie people tell themselves. I've dealt with a few folk in my life that said, I can't take anymore. I just can't take anymore. You ever said that? You ever thought it? You know what that's saying? That's saying, I'm in charge of how much I can take. I'm in charge of how much I can take. I can't take anymore. You know who's in charge of how much you can take? The Lord above. I can't take anymore. There have been times in my life when there was things, if you had told me about such and such, if this happened, could you take it? I couldn't take that. It happened, I took it very well. Start describing to you. You'd probably use, in your mind at least, a modern cliche, let's don't go there. I do catch on, you know, a few modern things. Sometimes when folk in talking say, well, let's look at the worst scenario. Maybe you've got somebody diagnosed with cancer, maybe you've got some very serious problem. You go talk to somebody that knows something about it. Maybe it's the doctor, maybe it's a lawyer, or something like that. And sometimes these folks will say, well, let's look at the worst scenario. I have actually known people that, and some of them I know very well, have replied back to those folks, let's not go there. What that means is I don't look at it. I don't consider it. Why? Because I can't take it. You see, I can't take it anymore. The one that's in charge of how much you can take is the God of glory. I assure you right now, the God of glory can give you the ability to handle 100 times what you're taking right now.
Amen.
It says, there have no temptation taken you, the substance is common to man. But God will not tempt you above that that you're able, but also will with the temptation, and once again that means test or trial, provide a way of escape that you may be able to bear. And there's things people do in this life that I hate to mention in the pulpit. You know how to do those things? They'll see a way out. Sometimes folks reach the point, they think they're out of options. Don't have any options. No way out but this. And if you ever get brought to that point, I promise you there is a way out. He says, God will with the temptation provide a way of escape that you may be able to bear. I've already mentioned this myth of indispensability. That there's a job I'm in this world to do, and if I'm taken out of this world, it won't get done, and the people that are dependent on me are going to suffer. I've already mentioned, if I'm not mistaken, I've already mentioned that this is a very common problem among parents of handicapped people. I've also seen it among a lot of other folks, but I want to deal a little more of that myth of indispensability. And about 52 years belonged to the Lord's Church, and a good percentage of that time to preach to them, not quite all of it. Not all, just started young. I've met lots of people, met lots of ministers of the gospel in many states. I've met a few that had it in their minds that they were indispensable to the church or churches that they served. They might not have used that word, but it showed in their attitude. I've known preachers when they came to the end of life's journey, began to make arrangements for the church, their churches they were going to leave behind. I've even known preachers that have instructed their churches from the pulpit to get a pastor from the bounds of such and such association and all that. I'm not trying to throw rocks at folks like that. The ones I have running through my mind now, I'm not going to call their names. They were my friends. I love them. I honor them. But love is not my subject. There was a very old friend of mine long, long way from here. No need to try to figure out who he is. I don't think there's over one person in this congregation who ever knew him, and I'm not so sure about that. Old preacher friend of mine, long way from here, now gone from this world, has spent about 40 years living in a strict association. He was coming to the end of the last journey, and he wanted to see everything taken care of. So, he starts putting up young men. And if they say Jesus left Moses' crept to save for grace, he called for ordinations. The whole world would ordain a stick of stone wood to say, you're saved for grace. First thing I knew, he'd ordained about five of them. Every last one of them flew the two. Some of them marveled. Flew the two. But before they flew the two, no need to try to figure out who they are. They aren't with us anymore. They flew the two. But before they flew the two, when they were still going through the roll, well, they ministered to the gospel. This old elder told me in sorrow, he said, I've ordained five of them, Brother Sonny, and every one of them's turned on me. They were all getting in trouble. Now then, we go back to the Old Testament, and we find Abraham and Sarah. And God had made them a promise. But here's Abraham, who's 100 years of age. Sarah, here is 90. Fourth chapter of Romans will tell you Abraham considered not his own body now dead. That means the reproductive ability, neither yet the deadness of Sarah's womb. Look back and emphasis his own death. Isaac's life was going to be a life from the dead. Deadness in his father's body, of course that's concerned, the deadness of his mother's womb. It's a life from the dead, because Isaac is a strong figure of the Lord Jesus Christ. Very well, God makes this promise to Abraham and Sarah. God doesn't fail this promise quite quickly enough to suit them. And so Abraham and Sarah decide that we've got to help the Lord. You know, we're indispensable, we've got to help the Lord. You Bible readers are very well aware that in trying to help the Lord, you know, Lord's got to help us in this. You know, we're sort of indispensable. In helping the Lord, they make this arrangement that Abraham brings a child into the world by this Hittite Egyptian, this Egyptian slave girl named Hagar. The child she produced was Ishmael. Ishmael, to that day, back in that day, became a thorn in the flesh to Isaac. Thorn in the flesh. Thorn in the flesh. And the power came to the world today is between the descendants of Ishmael and the descendants of Isaac. And I have said the primitive Baptist for 40 years or better, the tapes are available. A lot of folks today listen to this thing I preached back in 1973 and 74. I've said to God's people for many years, some of you folks here were hearing it in 1973 and 74, since history runs in a circle, the Mideast, of course, is known as the cradle of civilization, and it will be the grave of civilization. Give it a little time, it'll all work out. I also said to God's people back in 1973, and folks today will remind me of, folks around still listening to the tape, maybe I'll listen to them. I thought to say, well, I'm a smart aleck. Who do you think he is? Think he knows everything. But be that way, I've seen God people over 30 some odd years ago. We have folks that have a world assigned to you out here. So, it was torn on the back of the law of the bill, 1934. No, the sword was the torn. That means new world order, new order in the ages. Nothing is said about that. That's kept under wraps. And folk like me who tried to tell people about it, people didn't come up hard with me. Say, look, they kind of cross-eyed. I never heard of this. And always remember this. Whenever you try to teach people something they've never been taught before, your idea must go through three stages. In stage one, since I've never heard of this, can't be nothing to it. You ever heard that one? Tell folks something, you know, about the latest medical research or something, latest thing been discovered. I never heard of that. Can't be anything of that. I never heard of it. That reply has a lot of conceit in it. What they're saying is, I've heard of everything. And if there's anything true, I've heard of it. And since I never heard of that, that can't be so. Actually, stage one. Try to teach people something they've never been taught before. I can't do anything with that. I never heard that. Stage two. Part of people believe it, part of them don't. If the person who introduced the idea says anything about it, well, you may be right, but it's irrelevant. Stage three. When everybody knows it, everybody believes it, the person who introduced the idea mentions it, oh, why are you harping on that? We all know that. Bottom line is, you never win. Okay, very well. I said to God, people found 30 years ago, that the designs, that the CFR, the Illuminati, the International Bankers, the Skull and Bones Society, and the movers and shakers of this world, have a wonderful world out here for you folk. The monkey ranks that are being thrown in it will be by the Ishmaelites. You say, although we believe some great world leader will rise and control the entire world, no, God stopped short of that. Because every text that folks have ever gone through in the Bible try to prove that to me, and they point to this text that says, teaching that great world leader who's controlling the entire world, I show them that that great world leader has got people rising up against him, he's got headaches. What achieved total control? There's some folks on this earth, the Bible says, will never be controlled. So if Israel his people, he should be a wild man, every man's hand should be against him, his hand should be against every man. We won't ever go that far. Okay, be that as it might. We've got to help the Lord. And in helping the Lord, they produced the Ishmaelite, which became a thorn in the flesh to the promised seed, Isaac, that God didn't send. And sometimes, old preachers, pastors, even churches. Look out here and they see a dearth of ministers, places to be filled. We've got to help the Lord along. And we make us a preacher. We're ordained a preacher. God never calls. And whenever you do, you're preaching the Ishmaelite that will be a thorn in the flesh for the ones God really sends. Several years ago, I went on a little private poll, and I didn't let it be known. I didn't go out among folks saying I'm doing a little poll, a little research. I just kept it to myself. But back in those days, I'd be in the company of somebody who was the soundest man I knew anywhere. Nearly all of them dead. In fact, I'd almost say, take the nerve out of it. The ones I'm thinking about are all gone. Well, I was a company of men who had they had abundantly proved their ministries. God had blessed their labors. Men that obviously had remained sound in the faith, pillars among God's people, and I could name them, but I will not. Somewhere in my visit with them, I would ask them, I'd say, brother, in your years in the ministry, what percentage of trouble has been caused you by men that you have no doubt that God called them to preach? Some of those brethren think what? Some of them think a long time. The replies were usually like this. Very little. Or none at all. Did you hear what I was asking them? Remember what I asked them? Very little, or none at all. Somewhere on to say, there were times along the way I had some problems with them that I sense that feel like are dark called preachers, but said we always resolve them. Now, settle them. Reply I would give you as very little. Problems I have had with brethren that I felt, have no doubt, were God called preachers. And what I mean by that, love the flock more than themselves. We resolve them.
Yeah.
You know why we resolve them? Because we both came to the point that we realized that this is doing the flock more hurt. It's damaging to the flock. And the flock of God is more important than my little bit of pride and my little bit of wounded feeling.
Right.
Have I lost anybody? This true God called servant that's had a difference with another God called servant, if they're servant of God, eventually they start thinking about the flock out here and how the flock is suffering. And even though this brother may still have some of the reservations and feelings, and they may have some of that toward each other, they're willing to bear it and put it behind them.
Right.
For the good of the flock.
Right.
You say, well, I know a lot of preachers are not doing that and won't do it. Well, you tell them I said they don't love the flock. You say, well, they won't like it. Well, they probably don't like it anyway. Which doesn't make me nervous enough to take half a baby out. Hear what I said? I have scripture to back up what I'm saying here. But the true servant loves the flock. Okay, let's bring something else. Okay, here we have elders. I mean, God's people. I'll finish that. God's people. We talk about our menus and their preacher factories and all that. We've got a pretty good one going ourselves. And at least they produce men can stand up and speak in their college and can at least attend. Well, I won't comment on the woo-woos we can sometimes put in the sand. That's all coming by people that don't wait on the Lord, don't depend on, you say, we need preachers around here. Bible tells us what to do that, do about that. Pray that the Lord of the harvest would send forth laborers into his harvest, and that does not say more laborers, no it does not, don't care how many times you've heard it quoted that way, it doesn't say pray that the Lord of the harvest would send forth more laborers, it says laborers. If it said laborers, then maybe some of us who think we're laboring in the kingdom to put our little fowls out, you both pray that God will send you some more like us. It says send forth laborers. Makes me wonder sometime if any of us are laborers like we ought to be. That word more is not in there promptly. Okay, very good. I'll give you examples tonight. A preacher's at the end of life journey thought they were indispensable. Tried to make arrangements for things thrown after they left this world. I say in all due kindness that my brother Boston put together, I praise you for the mental treasure of memories of the brother and I had in mind. But they forgot that they're not the Lord and they're not the Holy Spirit. If I never make it back home to the church I pastored about 40 years, I've got enough faith in Almighty God that somewhere God loves those people, that God is able. He might not do it in 3 months, might not do it in a year, but God's able. Now then, one folk get it in their heads that they're indispensable. What I'm doing among the old Baptists, if I get taken out of this world, who's going to handle it? That's a rotten attitude. It's unscriptural. It's off track. And I say to every preacher in this building, or any preacher may hear these tapes, or to any mother out here, you think you're indispensable to the rearing of your children, or to any mother and dad of a handicapped person, or anybody's got to care for a disabled person, or you're in a position, you've got little babies in your arms right now, and if something happened to me, what's going to happen to this little baby I have in my arms? God is able. And there may be some of you here who think you're indispensable. I'm going to put you a little test so you find out whether you are or not. I'm going to go this verse low. It's very complicated. When you get home tonight, get a bucket of water, a gallon will do, 5 gallons do better, and fill it with water. Now, stick your fist down in it. Now, yank it out fast as you can. If it leaves a hole, you're indispensable. That's a lot to remember, I know. But let's move on. Myth of indispensability. You think this is an old hard-shell preacher up here just ranting and raving? If you've got any psychiatrist, this city have a head screwed on right. You have any counselors know what they're doing. You have any psychologists in this town know what they're doing. They'll tell you that there's many, many people laboring under that burden. It was a great relief to my wife years ago when she recognized before God that she's not indispensable. It was a great relief to me when I finally saw that I'm not indispensable. Next myth, next lie people tell themselves. As I go through this life, I want people to like me. I want people to understand what to do. I want to be approved by folk. I think it's called peer pressure. I call it nonsense. There's folk everywhere. Now, there's a lot of folk where I go to high school, a lot of folk where I work, a lot of folk here and there don't like me. A lot of folk don't understand. I can think of a particular primitive Baptist preacher, wouldn't name him. That poor brother's got the worst hang up any man ever knew. That's the idea of somebody misunderstanding. Well, a long span of years ago, never mind who it is, I could use a bunch of people you don't know. Well, it's a long span of years, sometimes a man preaches something, he writes something, and somebody misunderstands it, and he comes back, got to write 16 pages, and just drives him full of bass. Because everybody doesn't understand. You think everybody's supposed to understand you? Everybody's supposed to understand you. Everybody's supposed to understand what you're doing. You know why you're doing what you're doing? Everybody's supposed to understand why you want to put your handicapped child in institution. Everybody's supposed to understand why you want to put your mother in a nursing home and go off and forget it. Everybody's supposed to just don't understand why you're so generous to the church. Trying to make a show, you know, maybe trying to bow your way into a deaconship. Folks don't understand what I'm doing. And folks don't understand, like the preacher have in mind, what I said. You expect everybody on earth to understand you? Understand what you're doing and what you're saying? You're living under a lie. You expect everybody to watch you and approve what you're doing? You told yourself a lie. Because once upon a time there was a perfect man on this earth. Perfect person. But a lot of folks didn't understand what he did. They accused him of having all kinds of motives. Lord Jesus Christ. Folks saw what he did. Saw what the motives in it. A lot of folks didn't understand. They didn't approve. Well, he himself taught us, Luke chapter 6, verse 26, woe unto you when all men speak well of you, for so do the false prophets. You know what the Lord just told? If you're trying to live right, you're living like he told you to live, everybody isn't going to speak well of you.
Right.
So, right. We come to 1 Peter chapter 4. Peter tells us over here, writing the people of God, he said the time past of our life may have sufficed us to have wrought the will of the Gentiles, when we lived in revelings, we lived in lasciviousness and lust and excess of wine and banquet things and revelings and abominable idolatry. It's interesting to go back and study the definitions of all those words. Gets pretty rough. So there was a time past your life when you were satisfied to live in lasciviousness, lust, excess of wine, you figured that out, banquet things. Abominable idolatry, revelings, so that made you happy. But there came a time when you quit that. He says, your former friends think it strange that you run not with them to the same excess of life, having evil to speak on. And if there's time passed in your life when you enjoy such things as that, honky-tonking, partying, all this kind of stuff, and the Lord shows you you need to give all that up, you can be just as kind to your former friends as you've ever been. You have no desire to mistreat them. You're just as kind and cordial. You don't tell them, I love Jesus, get out of my life. You don't have to run them off. Be as kind to them as Scripture allows you to be. But they're going to change toward you. Because for a second, they're going to notice that you're not telling the same type of jokes they're telling. You're not talking about the same things they're telling. And you don't have the same plans for tonight or the weekend they've got. And bring nice-looking women and such as that, purposeful languages to communicate. You're not making the same comments they are. They're going to speak evil of you. They're going to call you a holy Joe, a religious God, a fanatic, all that type of thing. They're holy names. Now, here in this world, if you get over here in Charlotte, North Carolina, going to the races, and work the circuit, some people do, by the way, they just do it year-round, get you a great big RV, and stuff in the pullet, and plenty of booze, and go over here to Camp Caledy at the, we'll start Charlotte Motor Speedway, then come to Caledy in Alabama, and then come out work the Texas Motor Speedway, and head on and make the big circuit, make into the Indianapolis. If you say something like that, you're a fan. If you do the same thing pursuing bluegrass music, country and western, football, baseball, I'm pursuing something like that, you're a fan. If you're coming several nights a week to a meeting like this one, you're a fanatic. You're either a fan or a fanatic, depending on whether you're chasing the world or the things of the Lord. He said, somebody's going to speak evil of you if you try to live like it. Lord says, well, I'm going to all men speak well of you. It's an unrealistic goal, and it's a myth, it's a lie that you told yourself that everybody's got to like me. Everybody's got to approve of what I'm doing. Everybody didn't approve what the Lord did. And in my lifetime, as I look back, there have been enough people who have understood me and enough people who have approved of me to make me healthy and sassy, and there have been enough people who do not approve of me and who do not like me to keep me on my toes. If everybody approved of me and everybody liked me, I'd probably drop my guard and no telling what I'd do. I told my friend, I told old Baptists for 40 years before they think I'm joking. I am serious as a heart attack. Very serious. I told them for about 40 years before that. I can handle my enemies. Please protect me, my friends. Sometimes well-meaning friends can do you a lot more damage than a malicious enemy. Study about that in a while. Okay, very well. Everybody doesn't approve of me. Everybody doesn't like me. I shouldn't expect it.
Right.
Woe unto you when all old men speak well of you. If you ever come to my country, and you go down on Possum Kingdom Lake, where the beer joints, the dives, and the bars are, and there's folk down there, their eyeballs look like a road map of the United States, you ought to have to put liquor stamps on their breath. And they think it's much old Sunday piles that's preached for 40 years on KFWA, pastored one church by 40 years. If they speak just as well of me as the God-fearing, decent people around there, something wrong. That's a myth, a lie. People tell themselves. There's more of them than I can deal with tonight. They would maybe pay everybody. And spiritually, be good for all of us. We do a little soul searching. Are there any ideas that I have in my head and that I'm acting on that won't stand the test of the Word of God? Let's go to Galatians chapter 6, verse 3. The Apostle Paul says, if a man take himself to be something when he's nothing, he deceiveth himself, lying to himself. If a man thinketh himself to be something, when he is nothing, he deceiveth himself. A lot of folks lie to themselves and that they think themselves to be something. But you're deceiving yourself. You preachers, pardon me. But over a long span of years, I've heard thunder from our pulpits many times. The office of the minister is the highest office on the earth. I have one preacher acquaintance, especially fond of that one. I couldn't tell you the time, I'm not going to call the poor man's name, but I watched him around like, the office of the minister is the highest office on the earth. Well, that gives you an ideal world, Elder. But this isn't an ideal world. This is Tennessee. And if that offends you, I'll make it Texas. Office of the ministry is the highest office on the earth. I hope you God's people, you're aware of that. You folks are aware of that. You godly people here know something about the book. you believe that. You're aware of that. The folk out here in the world aren't aware of it. Some of you preachers out there laboring on that delusion. The world, I held the highest office on the earth. That's an ideal world. Sure, I feel what you do. Some of God's people feel what you do. Well, let's try this one in the morning. This brother takes me out to the airport very early in the morning. There's a long line there. And I'll step out of your car and say, I'm a minister of the gospel. I hold the highest office on the earth. It is for a signal that I have fixed this for you to mix this because I've got to get my wife, my mother-in-law, and my little boy. And I've got to proceed to Texas. I must get there to fill my office. How many of you think they'll step aside? If you think they're going to step aside, I'll make you a good deal on Brooklyn Bridge after this service. I'll also sell you some ocean property in the West. Some of you preachers that still out of the illusion, I hold the highest office on the earth. Next time you're going down the road, you pull a car out, and you hop up to a place. And there's a big old fella in there busting tires, and he's got about 9 ahead of you. You go in there in your little preacher suit, and you tell him, I'm a minister of the gospel, I hold the highest office on the earth, I want you to discard all these other cars and get you my tire first. And lightning, tell me how it works out. You say, may we email me? No, I'm not that far along in world history. I'm still trying to develop a Christian attitude toward a telephone. I've had a lot of folks like to deal with things the way they ought to be in an ideal world. I cannot cope. I can't live in an ideal world. That world out there is an ideal. It's under the curse of Satan. A lot of folks live in la-la land when it comes to this. When the word went out, my sister's husband had colon cancer, probably not going to survive. There were folks in my own family, not Primitive Baptist, with the understanding of the Bible, like I hope you have. But the folks in my own family, good folk, godly folk, very shallow in understanding. I heard this from several of them. This is not fair. Milton lived a good life. Gene and Milton are good people. This isn't fair. Anytime you look at things going on out here in this world, somebody leaves this world very early. Or here's somebody here that's worked very hard in life, and they lose everything they have in a tornado or fire, and somebody over here not worth killing wins the lottery. And you're about to say that isn't fair. You just told yourself a big lie. First of all, you started out with the assumption that that mess out there is fair. It isn't fair. 1 John 5:19, we know that we're of God, the whole world lies in wickedness. That mess out there isn't fair. It hasn't been fair since Adam brought sin into the world, and death to sin is turned upside down. Men of God in the book of Acts are now preaching the gospel, and they accused him of turning the world upside down. Well, that's a lie. Adam turned it upside down, and when you preach to people and they straighten up, you're turning a little bit of it right side up, but not the whole thing. Some of you youngsters, graduate from high school, go to college, you expect to get out here in this world and be treated fairly, you're telling yourself a lie. This world out here isn't fair. Right. Don't expect it to be fair. Right. Now then, I'll give you, if I, I've got a quickie somewhere, I'll give you a few of my little quickies that I've used for many years to survive the battles of life. One of them is, you've probably heard me say it before, and you're going to hear me say it again. You say, something you said this before, so what? Sometimes I have to say it to myself 7 or 8 times a day. I worry very little about things over which I have no control. You got to listen to that statement carefully. Sometimes things arrive in my life just like they do yours, and I'm tempted to worry about it. First thing I ask myself, do I have any control over this? Before I left home, I made a little mental note for myself that last Tuesday, I better get on the call and make an airline reservation for a trip I've got to make 3 weeks down the line, because if you don't, you're going to pay through the nose and may not get the seats. I kept putting it off. I knew there was something eating on me. And let me tell you a little secret. I decided to make an airline reservation. I live under this little myth myself. I live under a myth. Maybe something happened, Lord, and I want to take this trip. Maybe they'll find somebody else preaching and I stay here and say one day. Maybe I want to take this. Just get a 7 weeks off. Or maybe the Lord will come back before then. That's to keep making that reservation. I think at least one preacher here is going to figure this out. But after all, I had to face facts. I didn't realize how much it was worrying me until I went upstairs and made it. I worry very little about things over which I have no control. I had some control over that. And it was bugging me more than I thought. A lot of your worries are procrastination, failing to face what you've got to face. Yeah. Remember this, don't ever forget it. It is following the path of least resistance that causes people and rivers to become crooked. Following the path of least resistance will cause you to get bent out of shape physically. You know you ought to walk so many miles a day. You know you ought to exercise. You know you ought to do this. You ought to stay in good physical shape. You know all that. Excuses. Follow the path of least resistance. You wind up bent out of shape physically. Following the path of least resistance that causes rivers, the Brazos River, 2 miles from my house, is crooked. You know why? Follow the path of least resistance. Mississippi's crooked. They're all crooked. They follow the path of least resistance. Following the path of least resistance will cause you to get bent out of shape physically. You'll get bent out of shape morally, and you'll get bent out of shape spiritually. That path of least resistance will keep you from coming here tonight. It'll keep you from going to your home church Sunday. It'll keep you from doing a lot of things you ought to do. Yeah, pardon my preaching manner. I was performing a wedding. I wasn't married. This is 2004. I better upgrade my lingo. Oh boy. I was performing a wedding for a young man who had a lot of military experience. Well, after a while he told the folks, I was getting confused. I didn't know whether to say I do a salute. Well, I hate to treat God's people this way. I worry very little about things over which I have no control. Do I have any control over this? And the answer is yes, get busy doing it. If you have no control over it, turn it over to the Lord. Yeah. Now then, the way life is supposed to work, as a man gets older, he's supposed to worry more and more about less and less till finally drives himself crazy worrying about nothing. You think that's wild? Read Ecclesiastes chapter 12. When that man gets old, the grasshopper should become a bird. The way life is supposed to work, man as he gets older, he worries more and more about less and less till he drives himself crazy worrying about nothing. I've always been aware of it. As I get older, I find myself worrying less and less about more and more till I'm finally not going to give beans about anything. Thank God for it. Because the older I get,
I realized how little I controlled. I don't control much as I thought I did. And the more I acknowledge that, happier I am. I wish I had a lot of time to talk to you about that one. American people are programmed today to be control folks. You're supposed to have insurance to cover every eventuality in life, health, life, and then if you get put in a nursing home, long-term care, supposed to be insured against everything, supposed to have it all under control. I realize I don't control much. Okay, very well, I've got to quit. I worry very little about things over which I have no control. I accept many times in life, it's not events that happen to you in life, it's your interpretation of those events. I like the way your pastor said it even better. It's not your view, it's your point of view. Thank you, Gretchen. Now I've got to close out somewhere, so I'll just close with one of my life's jewels, one of my most precious memories. And some of you may have heard this before, that's fine. One of my life's jewels, one of my precious memories. There's time, it's hard to believe, it's approaching maybe 10 years ago. There's time about 10 years ago, I finished preaching in a place, there's one up my arm, there's a sister met me, probably there in the middle 40s, give or take. She said, "Both times I haven't seen you in about 2 years," said I would have gone completely off my rocker, basically because of things that's happened to me in the last 2 years that hadn't been something you said in one of your sermons. She said, "I wrote it on my mirror, but I put up my makeup on in the morning, take it up off at night, said I've got it in my purse." And she began telling me what happened to her in those last 2 years. I don't go into all the details. Husband left them. Both her son and daughter gone. Well, it caused a lot of grief, a lot of things, health problems, et cetera, et cetera. Troubles, et cetera. Now, this sister didn't have imaginary troubles. She had real ones. She said, "There's something you said in one of your sermons that's pulled me through it." And I even had it in my purse, written in my purse. I'm stuck in your purse. Well, I'm standing here wondering about what deep, dark, that deep, dark, profound theological point I made that had helped this poor lady through so many trials. She pulls it out, lets me leave. "Every thoroughbred dog needs enough fleas biting him to keep him reminded that he's a dog." She said every time another trouble came, she said instead of envisioning this as a big lion or something going to eat me up and destroy, said I envisioned this as a little flea that's come my way to remind me that I'm a dog saved by the grace of God. God bless me to have a wonderful life. I was on a plane a while back. This young girl was on the side of me. I just college age. I have no good judge of that anymore. And they were on the so they could be together. And I got the aisle. Well, they continued to talk. And when I'm turning at you, you know, if you have a family, I suggest it is. Very nice girl. But they were talking about marriage and, you know, maybe finding the right one and, you know, having a hard time and et cetera. You ever heard of that? When I'm turning, I said, "You married?" I said, "Oh, yes." "How long have you been married?" I said, "My wife and I have been married 47 years. To each other?" I said, "Oh, yeah." "Well, you think that's crazy? This is 2004, children. 47 years to each other?" I said, "Yeah." "My wife and I have been together happily, better than 47 years, a little past 47 years. God bless his three wonderful children, five outstanding grandchildren, two wonderful in-laws, don't have any problems with them, thousands of friends across the country. At this point in life, I'm not bragging. I just thank God for it. I could get the rug pulled out from me at any time. I could take all the medicine I've ever taken in my life and put it in a cereal bowl. It may not always be. Well, when God has blessed you that much, it might get you here just very well. Got it?" You know, something a little unique about me, I suppose you poor sinners out there, been taking medicine all your lives, your children split up and divorced, you and your wife divorced, you had all kinds of trouble and all that. You know, the devil might tell me, "You're one of my special anointed vessels." Some of you folk out here, God's blessing soul, maybe you can tell a greater blessing story than I've told. I have to start telling mine.
We could get in our heads with thoroughbreds. Every once in a while, fleas come on, start biting. They're not now an old dog, saved by the grace of God. Last shot I want to take at you. There's a dear sister in my home church. I've pastored her for many years. This sister has real troubles. Extends on out to her children and her grandchildren. She has many troubles. They're not imaginary. She has many troubles. Same old step to my home church while I'll get to be about a year ago. She became very concerned about her unhappy children, unhappy grandchildren, and trying to solve the problems and all this type of thing, and telling me about it. And this is not a hypochondriac. This is about a real problem. I said to her, I said, well, I suggest you go home this afternoon, get off the quiet corner for the Lord, and turn in your resignation as general manager of the universe. Next week, Mace came up to me and said, I did it. It worked. I had a pretty good week. But said, I'm drifting back where I was. What do I do now? I said, turn it in here. May God get you there.